lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what it shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller and my guest this week is Leif Holberg. Leif is an internationally acclaimed author, consultant, licensed mental health professional, educator, and avid lover of nature and animals. Her professional career and life's work have centered around researching the human-equine bond and studying the inclusion of horses in mental health and learning. Leif is considered one of the foremost leading experts in the equine-assisted mental health and equine-assisted learning industry. She's been involved in the industry since its inception in the early 1990s and has developed a reputation over the last 20 years for her broad-reaching and objective study of the industry. It's been Leif's goal to clarify, define, and objectively describe the complexity and diversity of the human-equine relationship and the professional applications of this relationship. Leif was a riding instructor and a horse trainer first, and so relies upon both the science and study of horses and her practical experience to put understanding horses and equine welfare at the top of her priorities when training professionals, consulting programs, or offering services. That's the technical part of Leif's profile, but you know, after having a conversation with her, she really fits in with what we've been talking about here on the podcast recently about our roots as hunter-gatherers, how we're supposed to live, how we're supposed to be connected to each other and the land. And having this conversation with Leif, that really came through. And, you know, I know that intro sounded like there's a lot of technical jargon, but Leif's not really about the technical jargon, but she definitely is about connection with all things in nature. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode of the podcast as much as I did recording it. Leif Holberg, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited and grateful to be here.
Hey, I'm excited to have you here. You know, the whole equine-assisted therapy thing these days, it seems like it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you're one of the, you know, the original people who were interested in that sort of thing. Why don't you tell us real quick, briefly, even though I would have read out your bio in the intro, what is it you do these days?
What is it I do these days? Oh my goodness. Well, I do a lot of things. So probably the thing I do the most that takes the most of my time is I provide individual transformational coaching sessions to people via Zoom. So I use a somatic experiential approach that's something I've learned from the horses that I've translated over into all my work with people, even when it doesn't include horses. So I do that. I see about 16 to 20 clients a week. And then I do, I'm writing I'm actually editing, which is the first time I've done that before. I'm editing a book, bringing in a bunch of different contributors from around the industry and around the world. So I'm very excited about that. And then I teach at, you know, I teach workshops when that's appropriate. I offer a master class. That's a pretty in-depth, long-term course of study. I collaborate on a Facebook group that does a bunch of interviews and things like that with people in the industry. So just a lot of different things that kind of come together into a whole.
Well, I got a lot of questions just from that little bit. Let's back up to the last thing you said, interviews with people in the industry being...
Yes, the industry of including horses in mental health and learning.
Okay. Perfect. So you just said you're editing another book. How many books have you written?
I have written 3 books to date, so this will be the 4th. So the first one I self-published in 2008, and that was called Walking the Way of the Horse. So that was just looking at the role of the horse in mental health and learning, and all the different ways that could be kind of applied, and different models and considerations for the inclusion of horses.
Is it more of a like an instructional book, like a textbook sort of thing, or is it more like an experiential yes. read? No, it's more for people who are yeah. in the industry. Okay.
Yes, yep. absolutely. Yeah.
Perfect.
So that was the first one.
Yeah.
And then the second one was published by Routledge, which is an academic press. So that was a different thing altogether, a big learning curve. So that was the clinical practice of equine assisted therapy. And that included a really comprehensive review of kind of all the peer-reviewed research that's been conducted studying the inclusion of horses in mental health and learning, and also occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy. So pretty comprehensive, in-depth look at, you know, how this work is working. Is it working? Why might it be working? And how is it working? And then that one came with a companion workbook. So, which was just to kind of help as a learning guide for, you know, professionals and also for colleges and universities that use the book. So those were the 3 that I've published thus far.
Okay. You just said that one was about why is it working and how is it working. Can you share with our listeners what you think horses do in, in that situation for people's mental health?
Yeah, that's a huge question.
No, sorry. I did it at the start of the podcast because you got like 2 hours to get this sorted out, you know?
Excellent. Well, do you think, I'm wondering if it might be, I'm wondering, there's a story about how I came into this, and I'm wondering if it might be appropriate to share that story as a framing to start talking about that question. Do you think that would be helpful?
Sounds like the perfect segue.
Okay, awesome. So I was a horse trainer. I grew up in a really kind of different way, which we can talk about if that seems appropriate later.
Let's talk about that. Well, actually, let's talk about that now. Let's do it in chronological order. You grew up in let me guess, you were homeschooled?
Yes.
Yes. And you, were your parents hippies?
Well, that's an interesting question. They tried to be hippies.
Okay.
They were wishing to be hippies, but they sort of missed some of the, like the marks of the good hippie, but they had maybe some of the deeper, more authentic qualities of the hippie movement. So they moved from San Francisco to Northern California in the 60s. But my dad came from the Coast Guard and was a massive athlete and actually played for the Giants, played baseball, played football. So very different kind of origin. You know, they weren't, they weren't maybe originally hippies, but as they moved to Northern California, they took up gardening and started the first organic nursery in Northern California.
Where was
it? In the 60s, in Mendocino.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we lived off
can
the
I,
grid.
Can I interrupt there for a second?
Absolutely.
Can I take a stab at what they were growing organically in Mendocino in the 60s?
You can, except for you might actually be wrong.
And okay, that might I be might. Part I of
might. So that was part of the problem, is that they weren't fully hippies. So like they didn't do any drugs and they didn't grow pot and they, you know, they grew like organic, you know, vegetables. And
that's pretty,
like
that's pretty hippie-ish. I was going to ask you, how does one fail at being hippie? Because I'm getting a little bit there these days. I'm just wondering, you know, some of the roadblocks I might run into, you know.
I would say that might in the past have been one of them.
Okay.
You know, so yes, yeah, so they ran an organic nursery. We lived off the grid, so no running water, no electricity, walked to our house. homeschooled, primarily for two reasons. One, because of our location. So it made it certainly hard to access. But also two, because I was a pretty different learner. So I had significant dyslexia, and I mean, mom tells the story, like I didn't even speak English until I was, I don't know, old, like four or something. I spoke some strange gibberish language. I didn't exactly fit in, let's put it that way. So they needed manure for the garden, right? And so there was a local stable, and they would go, grandma and mom and dad would go, and they would not just go to the manure pile and load manure into the truck and take it home. No, they would go and clean the stalls at this stable for free, and then remove the manure and take it back to their garden. So after doing this for quite some time, the owner of the stable finally approached them and said, well, hey, you know, because I would be with them. So finally the lady said, you know, do you want your daughter to maybe have some riding lessons in exchange for cleaning our stalls? So they agreed, and I thought that was a great idea. And so I started riding. And that was my first exposure to horses. And I was about, I think, three or four years old at that time. So it was an immediate love affair, I would say. I mean, I think my nonverbal, which now I'm very verbose, as you will learn. So I'm just making up for lost time, probably. But my sort of nonverbal issues and maybe the way I thought differently really worked with horses. So I think we were sort of like in a quick fit there.
I didn't speak gibberish. I didn't speak till I was two.
Yeah, wow.
And then when I started talking, I never stopped. And I'm wondering if that is a, you might know because of your education, but I wonder if there's a common denominator there to where is if you don't speak very early that you might end up speaking a lot. I don't know.
Seems like there's two of us at least in that boat, so we could probably find some more and make a case of it. Yes, I think, and I also think there might be a connection with horses around that. Is, you know, as I've learned so much more about dyslexia and learning differences, and really learning about the way, you know, how differently we can think and how differently we experience the world. And someone like myself, I think, the way horses experience the world and the way that horses function and operate was much more comfortable for me than humans. So it was a natural fit. And I wonder if that's the case for a lot of people that become really involved with horses and maybe involved with horses at young ages too.
Right. Yeah, might have something to do with it. So you started riding at this stable. Where did it go from there? Because remember, we're eventually going to get to the question of why does equine-assisted therapy work? But that's like in an hour and a half from now.
That's right. All right. So from there, time goes on, and my parents, there was this amazing summer camp in Northern California in this place called Compshi. And so I got to go to summer camp there one time, and somehow my parents got involved with the owners and they needed help. And so we moved, mom, dad, and I moved onto the camp property, which was a 600-acre ranch in Northern California, also all off the grid, and they raised Appaloosas. And so the man, Joe, who ran the camp was very individual. He was he did everything alone, or he, you know, it was like him, his wife, primarily just he and his wife that did most all of the work around the ranch. So we became, I think, a really valuable asset for them. So dad helped with like a bunch of the building work, and, you know, mom helped to, they had a son that had Down syndrome. So mom would help take care of Jared sometimes. And then I just was sort of Joe's like right hand person. And I started there at 10 or 11, and I was again homeschooled. And so, I started riding with Joe all spring. So basically we had about 40 head of horses that needed different things. So he had an amazing philosophy, which I know you would greatly appreciate. And one of the things that he believed in was to let the horses be horses all the way up until they were 4 years old. So we would do some halter training with them when they were really babies and, you know, do the basics just so that if we needed to, you know, any routine vetting or care that we needed, we could do that. But then they were not touched until they were four. So every spring we would have new four-year-olds. You know, we'd have the four-year-olds coming up that we would need to work with. And then we'd have like the five, six, seven-year-olds, you know, that we needed to kind of tune up. And then we'd have the older camp horses just to, you know, get them sort of back into the swing of things. So Joe and I, predominantly, sometimes Claudia, Joe and I did that all, you know, for months of the spring. And so I was out there from about 6 a.m. to probably dark, you know, or just before dark. And so I would have some touch of probably 20 something horses a day, sometimes even 6 days a week. So an enormous amount of learning occurred there. And it was learning about also ethology and about how horses, because they were allowed to be loose over 600 acres. And so they lived in their family groups. And they functioned very similarly to non-domesticated horses. So I got an incredible experience of like understanding horses in a different kind of way. And some of the things that were so remarkable was like accidents. We just had no accidents. We would start a horse and I mean, just there were no fireworks. I mean, nothing happened, you know, we put the saddle on and, you know, get to it. And so it was just the most beautiful experience of sort of seeing horses as non-aggressive, non-dominant, you know, non-resource guarding beings that are actually pretty safe and pretty and very independent and very self-thinking.
Where
I keep going.
Right. Where was that place?
It was in Northern California in Compshi, a little tiny town called Compshi.
What's Compshi near?
It's near nothing. let me think. It's like 4 hours from San Francisco. So it's by Mendocino. So it's an hour from Mendocino.
Okay.
It's an hour from a place called Ukiah. It's an hour from Boonville. Nothing.
Okay, now I know where it is. Yep. Very cool. So it's on that coastal range there.
Exactly. Yes, yep. it's inland from the coast, yeah.
Okay. Perfect. And so you ended up becoming a horse trainer for a while?
So yeah, from there I just sort of lived and breathed horses and I got my first horse training job, which is another very funny story. Perhaps for another conversation, but I got my first horse training job with Shelley Kreutzmann. So Billy Kreutzmann, the drummer for the Grateful Dead, his wife, they lived in our local community. They lived in Compshi.
Really? So it's such a, you know, this is not the Grateful Dead podcast or anything, but Dr. Rebecca Bailey, I don't know if you know her,
yes.
But she what did she do? She traveled with the Grateful Dead on the bus for quite a while. And I forget why she was, yes, I forget why she was traveling with the Grateful Dead, but.
I just interviewed her the other day. I got to circle back around and
yeah,
hear.
She had a lot to do with the Grateful Dead and I cannot remember why. And I'm pretty sure she did tell me on the podcast, but I can't remember now. Anyway, so yeah, so the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon or 7 degrees of the Grateful Dead, one or the other.
So that happened, kind of got my start and then just moved on to, you know, just that was what I was going to do with my life, right? Is I was going to train horses. And so I had a brief encounter with high school, managed to get in and out of there in about a year with all my homeschooling business that I'd done. So graduated high school early and headed down to your neck of the woods and by San Luis Obispo and started a small horse training business and just thought that was going to be my life, right? I was going to be a horse trainer. And then I had an experience, which is what's going to kind of, I think, take us into this question about how horses maybe can be helpful to humans. So I had a riding lesson client, kind of a middle-aged woman who was working in corporate America kind of job. And she came, you know, every week, and we, you know, we worked all the way through the walk and the trot and, you know, learning all about body position and aids and, you know, she had her 2-point down beautifully and everything was going. And I'm really, I don't let people move fast. I keep them, you know, I really slow things down, make sure they're really understanding what they're doing and that their body is strong enough to be able to move to the next stage so that they're not affecting the horses negatively. So finally, it's time for her to be able to canter, right? And she's now a competent, strong horsewoman, you know, so there should be nothing really problematic with moving into the canter. And she's riding a beautiful, soft, sweet little horse and everything's good. Should be good, right? So, all right, the day is upon us and all right, off she goes. She goes into the, you know, breaks into the canter, no problem. She's up in her 2-point. Everything looks great. And she's going around and I said, okay, that's great. Go ahead and break down to the trot and then to the walk. And absolutely nothing happens. Nothing. Her hands don't change. Her thighs don't change. She doesn't sit down. Nothing happens. And I'm, you know, asking her again, okay, go ahead and, you know, maybe she didn't hear me. Nothing happens. And so finally, I mean, they're going around and around. And finally, I just used some body and voice commands and, you know, brought the horse down to the trot and the walk myself and went over to her and said, what happened? And she just couldn't speak. She just couldn't articulate anything that had happened. And she just looked sort of distant and I just couldn't tell what was going on. And so we walked around for a minute and then she got off and had her sit down and drink some water and then, you know, checked in with her. She was okay. And she went home. So the next week rolls around and the exact same thing happens. Exact. And I have to stop the horse for her. She looks kind of funny. She gets off, sits down, drinks some water, check in with her. She goes home. Well, I don't remember how long this went on. It seemed like forever. And then one day, doing it again, I'm getting ready again, the whole repeat, you know, it's going to happen again. And all of a sudden, she just yells, stop, like screams it. And the horse comes to, you know, a sliding stop. I run over there thinking, oh my gosh, what just happened? What's wrong? And I get up to her and the woman's in tears. And I don't, you know, I'm asking what's happened. And then she says, Leaf, can I tell you something? And I said, sure. And she said, well, and she's crying and shaking. And she says, well, you know, I've been at this company for 10 plus years, you know, with the way, you know, this is in the 90s, you know, she's like, I'm really trying to work my way up, you know, into corporate leadership. And she said, my boss, who's really high up in the company, he's been raping me and he's been doing it for years. And I haven't wanted to say no or stop because I was so afraid that if I did, I would lose my place in this kind of corporate hierarchy and that I wouldn't be advanced and that I would lose my job. And she said, you know, after what we've been doing with the horse, I decided it was time to say no. And she said, I went in and I told the board what he'd been doing and they fired him. And now I'm safe and I have my job and I can continue moving up the way that I had planned to and wanted to, and he's gone and he can't hurt me anymore. And that happened because of this horse and what we were doing. And that was the moment I realized that something was going on. Nothing involved me. Not one thing had to do with me. That was about her and the meaning she made of that experience and the meaning she made of what she was doing with that horse. And it changed her life. And so from that moment on, I thought, there's something happening here that I am not understanding. And I'd like to know. And I'd like to understand what that is. And so that's how my journey in this particular part of the story begins.
Wow. Did you And where do I go from there? That was the start of the horse thing, but you at some point in time got a degree in psychology?
Yeah. Yes.
Was that next? Because no, it was the horse thing next.
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about that.
So from there I thought, well, clearly there's something going on. I want to understand it. And so I thought I'd better go to college, right? I think that's where you understand stuff like that. And I, you know, didn't ever plan to go to college. Never thought I could even get into a college, you know, never thought I could. Yeah, that just didn't seem within my capability or reach. And so my mom found this article about this college in Arizona where they took a horse trek across Spain following Don Quixote's footsteps to learn about, you know, the great works, the books, right? And she thought, well, that seems like a good college for Leaf, right? And it was Prescott College in Prescott, Arizona. And it's an experiential school. So there's like no tests and there's no, you know, those kinds of things. So all based on an experiential learning model. And so we went there for an interview and I got accepted and so I went. And then the most amazing thing happened, which was that that moment of like, I want to understand this. There's another part to it that started to unfold, which was that I really cared about horses and I really cared about nature and animals. And I didn't really care that much about humans. They didn't interest me too much. But what I was concerned by was the way humans treated animals and treated nature. And that really concerned me. And so I started thinking about it and I thought, well, okay, so I don't want to be a lawyer, right? And I don't, so how could I affect change, right? So the first thing I landed on was journalism, because by that time I'd learned to talk and read and write. So I thought journalism. So I could go to Prescott College and I could study environmental journalism. And somehow that would make a difference, right? But I was still a horse trainer and I still had this experience now and I was still really curious. So those two things didn't like connect yet. But my first year at Prescott College, there was a class offered and it was called Equine Therapy. And it was offered by this woman named Barbara Rector. And so I needed to be a TA for something, you know, at some point in my college, my undergraduate college time. And so being the kind of person I am, I trotted myself up to Barbara and said, hey, I think maybe you need a TA and I think I could be your TA. And she was like, oh, really? How come? And I knew nothing about equine therapy. I knew nothing about, you know, this whole thing with people and horses and well-being and health. I didn't know any of it, but I knew horses. And so I thought maybe I'd be helpful. And so Barbara, being her beautiful Barbara self, was like, you got it, Leaf. You're going to be my TA. And so Barbara is who is, you know, many times considered sort of the grandmother or the real kind of originator of this idea of including horses in mental health and learning. And so that was in the 90s when it was just barely in its infancy. Like she was just starting to teach about it and talk about it and guide people through some trainings. And so that's when I met her, was right then in the very sort of beginning of all of this and my very first year at undergraduate college. So that's what then sort of kicked off the beginning of that shift. So instead of going, so I tried the journalism thing and it just didn't feel like the right fit for me. And so, but Barbara kept offering these opportunities. And so she offered me an opportunity she got me connected with an entity that was called the Animal Therapy Association of Arizona back then. And she got me funding to be able to travel from the West Coast to the East Coast and back again, studying the emergence of equine facilitated psychotherapy in therapeutic riding programs all across the country. Hmm. So I was able to go and travel and interview all the people that were the sort of original pioneers of the work and really understand like what they were doing and what they saw happening with people and horses and what was working and what wasn't. So it really got me on that track, definitely right from the beginning.
And was it at Prescott College that you ended up getting a psychology degree?
So, yeah. So then what I ended up doing was changing my undergraduate to counseling psychology. So, and then Barbara, again, got me a job before I had even graduated at Arizona State University, heading up something they called the Alternative Intervention Research Clinic. So I didn't get my master's in counseling until a number of years later.
Okay. So when you finally did get your master's in counseling, thinking back to your client in San Luis Obispo who would freeze at the canter, I've got some thoughts just from what you told me, but did you ever unravel what exactly happened between her and the horse?
Yes. I started really understanding, you know, the effects of trauma on the body and how trauma is stored in the body and how the movement of the horse can elicit these sorts of freeze responses in somebody that has been sexually abused and other types of abuse too, but certainly sexual abuse, and really looking at how the movement of the horse can start to, can both be way too evocative, right? Like way too much for somebody, or can be used as a very intentionally administered therapeutic tool. Right. So if you are ready, if your client and you are ready, then that movement can open up memories and open up trapped, you know, energetic and emotional content.
Yeah. To me, it was as soon as you're telling me the story, I'm thinking she just completely dissociated. Like,
yes, 100%.
Quite possibly like she would do when the actual abuse was occurring.
Exactly.
And do you think it was the motion of the canter that brought it up? Yeah.
I think so. Mm. Yes. Yep. And I think the canter for some reason was just, you know, well, think about it. It's like, you know, it could have happened anywhere, right? It could have happened at the walk, but for some reason it was the movement and the fact that the gait elicited something, but it was also the idea of something feeling out of control and then having to say stop or slow it or no, you know, in that way too. Like perhaps for her, the walk and the trot felt safer,
Right. Yeah. You know, a few years ago, a good friend of ours who's actually been on the podcast a couple of times, Jane Pike, she's from New Zealand. She was talking to me about how, you know, sometimes people, they're not scared to canter. They're afraid of the power.
Yes, absolutely.
And sometimes they're afraid of power itself. Sometimes they're afraid of their own power. But power, because I not having an education, that I'd never considered the thought. You know, I just thought it was about the speed. Like, oh, they don't want to go faster.
Yeah.
But you know, when I rationalize it, like, well, you know, on a well trained horse, he's not really cantering any faster than you're trotting. If you had a pretty forward sort of a trot. So, you know, for me, it would be like, I don't know, I don't want Canada. But, yeah, it's a totally different, you know, there is a power that comes from behind in that canter stride that's not there in the trot stride.
Exactly. Yep, that sort of impulsion and that kind of, and even just the forward, you know, the sort of forward movement that, and it also moves our bodies differently, right? So.
Right. Did you ever keep in contact with that client?
I never did. Mm. I know. I wished I did for maybe a year or 6 months maybe afterwards. But that was it. Yeah. And it was before, you know, internet and cell phones and all right. those things that we have now.
Yeah. Just thinking about it now and knowing I know about trauma and stuff like that. It's like, she thought, oh, he's gone. I'm safe. It's like, you know, you've got all this stuck.
Oh, I know.
Trauma stuck in your body. You know, okay, you're now safe from that, but now you've got the rest of the stuff to sort through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was too part of what caught my attention was just this idea of like, what do you, you know, I am so at that moment, I had no skills, no training, you know, no ability to know how to even go, what to do with that information, right? Like, you know, luckily it was in my nature to kind of hold space and be right. comfortable or okay yeah. with that. But beyond that, you know, what is somebody supposed to do when that kind of information comes out? And also how much I started realizing how much I was seeing of people's, and this is, you know, no surprise to any of us now, but, you know, every time I'd watch people and their horses, I would start to see their stuff. Right? Showing up, right? Every single interaction, the way they walked, you know, the way they went to catch their horse, the way they spoke to their horse, the way, you know, every single second of that interaction showed me something about them. And, you know, I didn't know really what to do with that at the time.
Right. So most, I've had quite a few therapists on the podcast, but most therapists, when I question them about what got them into it, for the most part, the most common answer I get is that they had some issues, they saw a therapist, and they were so excited about the change in how they felt and how they lived that they wanted to share that with other people. Was there a part of that in your journey too?
Well, I don't know how to say this quite right, but, you know, unfortunately I came at it from this other perspective of like, I wanted to help the animals and I wanted to help nature. And so what I finally came to after I ruled out journalism and being a lawyer is, okay, who's doing the hurting? It's the people, right? The people are hurting the animals. The people are hurting nature. And so then I thought, well, what could I do that would help, like, would help people to see what, you know, see the beauty in animals and nature and understand them because of my own communication differences and the way I grew up. You know, I spent the vast majority of my time alone with horses. So I learned communication by being with them. I learned about relationship by being with them. I didn't really learn that so much about by being with humans. So I took what I learned from horses and I applied it to humans versus kind of the other way around.
Yep.
And so I got to thinking, well, maybe if we could teach people interspecies communication, like if we could teach people how to see that they're a part of this whole, you know, that we're not separate from it or better than it, that maybe that would stop them from hurting, you know, the beings that I personally like cared so much about. So I sort of went into it with that perspective, and sort of more of almost like a curiosity about humans, like because they were so foreign to me, really. So I was much more comfortable with horses and animals and nature than I was with people. So I think I came into it almost like with a little bit of a scientific mind around, well, what are these things? How do they work?
So once, okay, let's go on with the rest of your story then. So what did you do after Prescott College?
Well, so, after undergraduate, I did that job for a while at Arizona State, and then I started a nonprofit called the Esperanza Center. And so we worked in the prison system on Indian reservation, and we worked with a population that people don't necessarily think of this, but in Arizona, one of the gang violence on this particular reservation. It's one of the smallest reservations in the country, but the gang violence is like equal to Compton. I mean, it's, right. it's just insane. And so we worked with the horses to help, create some safe space, for the people to come and, be. We wished to do gang integration, but that was like a joke. We were able to create some inroads and some sense of safety that was able to be translated and had some really cool outcomes. So we did that. And then that work started to get kind of well-known around the Phoenix area. And we became the recipients of a vast majority of the Child Protective Agency's reintegration, family reintegration funding. So it was right at a time when they were starting to look at the difference between separating children, you know, taking children away from parents versus actually like figuring out ways to heal the family system.
Right.
Right. And actually reintegrate the kids back into that system after things had been dealt with.
Right.
And so nobody was doing reintegration work. It wasn't like nobody was trained to do it. It was just like this whole brand new Wild West sort of experience. And so a woman came out from one of the agencies and watched what we did and was like, this is where it's at. Like, this is amazing. And so we got the contract there. Then we got a contract from another agency and we just started doing that work. And so we would work with families, you know, ranging from 70 down to, you know, 5, doing reintegration with the horses. And all of that was done, was still very much on the learning side of things. It wasn't therapy. We weren't doing like family therapy, but we were really looking at ways to create new patterns, new communication skills, new ways of viewing one another. And so most all of the members had their own therapists who would either come and participate in the sessions or we would communicate with them and translate information so that we were all on the same page around what we were doing. But for the most part, those, you know, clients were separated because of things like, you know, child pornography and prostitution, and just horrible, like really bad sorts of situations that, so it was intense and powerful work. So we did that. As well. So we worked in the prison system and we did the family reunification. And then we also worked with prisoners who were released from like life sentences and had, you know, had been in prison for years and years and years and years and years, usually for some sort of pretty significant offense. And so we worked with them on reintegrating into society and community too. So that's what we did for a while.
What year would that have been, roughly?
Yeah, we started in 1999 in Phoenix.
Okay. I was just thinking about someone who's been in prison for a long time getting out, you know, not just the challenges of reintegrating in the world, but reintegrating into a world that's completely different than the one that was around when they went in.
Huge challenges. I mean, just technology,
right.
You know, just to begin with. I mean, you know, just clothing. You know, what you wear. Yeah, everything. Words, different words.
All right.
Yeah. This is amazing.
So with the family integration stuff, were you working with the child that was removed and the family at the same time or separately?
Yes. All. So we would start, we had different protocols. So we almost always, we would start based on the recommendation of the therapist. We might start with like one member of the family, two members of the family, like a triad, like three, you know, so we'd find like the right pairings of who we needed to work with. And because we'd be looking for where's the greatest riff, right? Like where's the tension point? And so we might build safety in between certain members in order to create like we build safety between maybe the siblings before we bring in the dad or we build safety between the mom and the dad, you know, before we bring in the kids
Yep.
So we just had these like very kind of thoughtful, intentional ways that we would pair. And then eventually we would be working with the whole unit. Yeah.
You know, what's really interesting, if I'm going to put a group of horses together, like, you know, like I'm going to, you know, we've got, we've got 11 horses, and let's say I want to try to get five of them all live in the same pasture or whatever. It's kind of how I go about the same thing. Like you pair the, you know, you know, what I do is I do all the groups of two or all the different collaborations of two. And then I do all the different collaborations of three, and then all the different versions of having four together. And then by the time you put five of them together, that's not a problem.
And, you know, I think seriously, Warwick, I think that's where I learned it, because I didn't have any training in doing this. I had no idea what I was doing. And I think that's exactly because I'd spent so much of my life, you know, that's what I did was horses. So that's where I learned that exact practice.
You know, it's really interesting what we can learn from horses. And you know, you were talking before about, you know, who's hurting the animals, who's hurting nature. And you also said you noticed the way people were around their horses. And you know, I've been doing clinics for quite a long time now. And for a while there, I would come home from a clinic and I'd say to Robin, oh, there's this, you know, there's one person there and they don't need a horse, they need a cat, preferably an outside cat sort of thing. You know, like they just can't get along with horses. Every once in a while they meet someone like that. But over the years I came to realize that it's not a horse problem they're having. They're not good with themselves. And so I've been more, not necessarily up front, but, you know, I've been more aware of that and taught more along those lines. Not that I'm a therapist, but I can make people aware of the problem you're having here is not the problem. This communication here is not the problem.
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can learn from horses. And, you know, what I think my big skill, you know, I think a skill is something or a talent. Let's quantify the difference between skill and talent. Talent is kind of innate. Skill is something you build on, and you can build on your talent too. But for me, I think a talent I have is being able to explain things to people in a way they understand, like create analogies. I don't, you know, when I do clinics, people go, oh, you explain that thing so well. And I don't sit around all day trying to think of it. It just kind of comes out of me in the moment. But the thing I do a lot is I figure out what people already know in other parts of their life, and then I you know, relate that, use an analogy for that to relate it to horses. But you can also do it backwards from, you know, you can start out with you can use the horse. I think what you guys probably do is use the horse thing and then relate it back to something like a different way they can show up in their life. For me, a lot of times, like I said, I'll you know, I have this little story that I call milk and eggs. And I'll say to people, okay, you ever write a shopping list? And they say yes. And I say, you ever buy milk and eggs? And they say yes. And I say, okay, what grocery store do you shop at? And let's say it's Safeway. I said, so there's a possibility you would have a piece of paper and the top of it says Safeway and then it says milk and it says eggs. And they say, yep. And I go, okay, so if you went out to your car, went to get in your car to go to Safeway to get these milk and eggs, and you noticed you had a flat front tire, would you go, maybe I should pump that up. Let me look at my list today. Do I have any tire pumping on my list? No, I've got Safeway milk and eggs. And then would you just jump in that car and drive it to the store? And they go, well, no. And I go, but that's what's going on here with your horse. You have this thing in your head that I'm going to do this today. You're not reading the signs that are coming up that saying, hey, your horse has a flat tire. You should put some air in it, you know, before you drive to the store. And, I try to use life lessons that people already understand. You don't ignore the flat tire just because you got milk and eggs and Safeway on your shopping list. You would put your shopping list aside, that goal aside, and go there. And so I'm rambling here, but I'm thinking with you guys, the things that you teach them with the horses, they can take back to the rest of their life.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying is so critically important, and I think it's part of what goes so awry in these horse-human interactions, and can go awry in the world of the therapy and learning folks as well, is that there can be this fixation on the list, right? So that's the activity, right? Like, we're going to do this with this person. So even if it's not with the horse, I mean, it involves the horse, right? But, you know, the list is like, the person's going to go and meet the horse and this thing's going to happen. And, you know, there's sort of this desired outcome that the professional can kind of hold on to, or like the idea that they're going to do this activity or they're going to have this kind of engagement. And a lot of times what happens is that the provider misses the flat tire. You know, right. They miss the signs that the horse is communicating or that the human is communicating in the pursuit of the outcome. So I think whether it's working with humans or horses, or humans and horses, the same is true. You know, I feel like it's so critical always to practice that art of just slowing down, right? Like taking like 10 steps back and saying, what is, like, for instance, I don't let people go in a horse gate ever without doing a whole grounding and centering routine. And I'm watching them that entire time to read their body, to read what's going on with them. I'm watching the horse, I'm reading what's happening with the horse. And only until I can sense that they're regulated and they're prepared are they ever allowed to actually like go into or near a horse. Because as soon as that happens, right, as soon as they go through that gate, it's like this, right? Everything goes. So their nervous system is going to, you know, change significantly as they move into that space. The horse is going to change. Their expectations are going to change. Everything's going to happen. And so, you know, getting somebody to understand how they are before they go in that gate and understanding sort of what that baseline is. And then as they go in, being able to notice when that's changing. And then step back again, right? Give space. So slow down, step back, see what's happening, watch. So no matter what the list is, you just throw it out the window, you know, until it's the time.
So what sort of grounding exercise do you have people do before they go in with the horse?
Yeah. So this is actually something that feels really important to me. I bet it might be similar for you and your work and horse people in general, but certainly in my industry. One of the things that happens is that people use horses as a down regulation tool. So they are dysregulated. They are not, you know, they are not in a grounded, centered space, right? And they go in and do something with the horses in the hopes of actually regulating themselves. Like, maybe they know that, maybe they don't, right? But that's sort of the purpose. And I've come to really feel like I don't want to do that to horses. Like, I don't actually feel like that's their job. I feel like that's our job. I feel like that's human work that we're putting onto the horses. So I teach people about their nervous system and about regulation way before we ever even get to the moment of the gate, right? So the gate is even sort of more down the process. So I'll do, you know, so all my sessions start out with some sort of guided meditation, a breathing practice, perhaps a body scan, perhaps like a senses, you know, a senses, like bringing awareness to your senses, yep. Anything like that.
Like a five and things then, you can see, smell, hear, touch. That's
exactly.
Okay.
Yep. And then, you know, some somatic kind of work around like what's happening in their bodies, what's emerging. So it just depends on how, where the person is at sort of from a cognitive, you know, just where they, who's showing up. Right. And sort of, then I adapt any of those practices to sort of be more appropriate or fitted for whoever the human is that's in front of me.
That's the art right there. That is the art, is to have a whole list of things that you can do and then be able to adapt. And it's the same thing with the horses, like trying to help people get along with their horses. And everybody would like to dot all the I's and cross all the, you know, like check all the boxes. And sometimes you don't check all the boxes, but Sometimes you do, and sometimes you only check half the boxes, but it's not the half the boxes you checked last time. And that's the, I think that is the, that's where the art.
Yeah, the nuance.
Yeah, the nuance.
And also you said, you know, you said it, you were talking about it earlier around just that, you know, how it's hard to teach people feel. It's kind of the same concept, right? Of like you just naturally can make those connections or make those sort of metaphors in the moment, right? It just comes to you. That's a hard thing to teach, you know? So one of the things I think about a lot when I'm teaching, because I do a lot of professional development for therapists and educators and coaches and things like that, wanting to get into this work, is really, again, how do we slow even that down? Right? So that we start to get more in tune with ourselves and our sense of intuition, because the inner knowing, right, is where that information is going to lie. So if we can trust ourselves, then we'll be able to more accurately respond, you know, with something that we have available to us.
Now you're getting down to the real stuff here. Like the inner knowing, the intuition, the how would I put this? The connection to the knowledge of the divine sort of thing.
Yes. Absolutely. And you know where that is the idea of embodiment, right? The idea that our bodies are our conduit, right? Our bodies are our way towards that greater knowing, towards that deeper knowing, towards that connection to the divine. Like we have to be first and foremost in our bodies before we can tap into, because it's just what horses teach us constantly, right? Is that if we are in our bodies, then we can rely upon our senses at a much more acute level. So even though we don't have a vulvar nasal organ the size of a horse's, right, or a dog, we still have one. So we can perceive, you know, information at a really amazing level when we tap into those senses of ours. But if we're cut off from our bodies and we're stuck in our heads, we're not going to have any of that information. You know, and then that connection to our senses leads us then to connection to the environment, right? And to nature and to all the information. I mean, think about how trees communicate with each other, right? Think about how a tree and a bug communicate. You know, all of that's available. It's just that, you know, we have to first get in here and learn about our own bodies and senses to then go out. And then I think that's where probably the connection to the divine happens most powerfully.
Yeah. Recently on the podcast, I've had a number of guests and we've been talking quite a bit about hunter-gatherers and how, you know, we basically have not evolved since then, but we don't live that life anymore, and so we don't use most of the, you know, a lot of the senses that we could use.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is I've had a number of, like, say, animal communicators on, things like that, and what's interesting is a lot of times their childhood is such to where that was normalized. And so
yes,
they didn't lose those senses because it wasn't like, oh, don't be silly, you're talking to your imaginary friend. That, you know, they had someone in their life who recognized, who totally understood the value of that. And I don't even know if they encouraged it, but they didn't shame them for having it, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you've even got to encourage somebody, a child, to do that, as long as you don't discourage them, because it's not like you've got to, it's not like you're trying to teach them something they don't already know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that.
Oh, totally.
And you know, you're a therapist, And we talk about, you know, talk about trauma and talk about, you know, things that happen to you. And there are things that happen to people, but this is not, the thing I'm talking about here is not something that happened to somebody. This is something that happened to everybody. This is our culture. You know, basically training out of us some of the things that are completely natural to us, and these things are the way we're supposed to live and operate.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's, you know, there's a couple of pieces. One, we all have trauma and get things stuck in our bodies, and, you know, they're from different things happening to different people. But then there's the umbrella of culture and society that you know, kind of makes us be in our head. I mean, if you think back to Descartes, when was that, the 1600s or something or other? I think, therefore I am. It's like about, it's all above the eyebrows, you know?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Yeah. So that, yeah, it's, and I'm unraveling, I'm unraveling a lifetime of being quite shut down. And in my head. So, it's really interesting. You know, I've just recently written a book, and the first line of that book in the introduction is, I've always been in my head.
There you go.
Because the book is The Principles of Training. And so it's about principles, and it's you know, I could kind of recognize things and categorize them and lump them together and go, oh, those kind of things fall under the same umbrella or whatever. And the introduction's on about how, you know, I've always been in my head and it hasn't served me well in a lot of places, but this book is one place it did, because I've got that very, you know, left brain analyzing, comparing, quantifying, that's that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it was, if you think about back, I mean, historically we have been taught, you know, that connection to nature was dangerous, right? Was, you know, the work of witchcraft,
right?
Was, I mean, the stories go on and on and on. I mean, you think about what happened with colonization and just like the, you know, you have to make somebody wrong if you're gonna violently, you know, abuse them and take over their land,
right?
And eradicate their practices and ways of being. And, you know, sometimes I think about that with horses too, around how, you know, we apply the same concepts. That's not, it's not like a fault issue. You know, it's not like that we're doing any of this consciously, but it's so embedded, you know, in how we were taught to see the world, the systems that are enacted and in place, you know. So it's kind of the same thing as like we approach horses, you know, in this similar way that we can think through things, or that, you know, we don't let them be themselves, you know. We do all this stuff to control them and determine, you know. Yeah, so
yeah, there's,
I think,
a very,
it's very similar.
There's a very old book a lot of people may have read, and in that it says something about men having domination over the beasts.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
One. Yeah, I do.
You know, so
I
do. So there's culture, you know, there's culture, there's society, there's governments, there's organized religion, all these things are so predominant, and it's almost like unraveling all of that stuff to get back to who we're supposed to be. And I think that's one of the cool things about horses is they're a natural thing. They act naturally. They bring you back to nature. You know, it's interesting, the more unraveling of trauma I do, and the more learning about nervous system states and things like that, is, you know, in the last probably 8 years, I guess, my practices with horses have completely changed. And the outcome is similar, kind of the same, not quite the same, but similar, very, and the outcome is very good. But it just comes with changing your perception about why they're doing the things they're doing, and, You know, and when, you know, I'm a big fan of Wayne Dyer, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And the, and yeah, for me, the big thing was completely understanding nervous system states. And we've got three horses here that are out of our mare. So one's 4-year-old, one's a 2-year-old, one's a yearling. And I did something different with them based on what I've learned about how trauma gets stuck in the body, you know, from reading Waking the Tiger by Peter Levine and In an Unspoken Voice and The Body Keeps the Score. Plus, you know, my experience is unraveling my shutdown state. But a lot of times with a foal, you'll grab a hold of them, you know, when they're first born because you've got to draw blood or give it an enema or, you know, treat their umbilical cord. And I used to make a point of not letting them go while they were struggling. So they're struggling, you hang on to them, and then the vet does what they're going to do, and then you let them go. And after reading about, you know, how trauma gets stuck in the body and that whole, you know, they've got to go, like, you know, in, I think it was in Waking the Tiger, they talked, you know, the medics in Vietnam used to say, as they go in, so they come out. So if they go under anesthesia screaming, they come out screaming. Anyway, so what I did with these foals was I, you know, when they're first born, you got to hold them and treat their umbilical cord, give them enema, draw blood, whatever. What I would do is, you know, when you hold them, they struggle, and you keep a hold of them, they stop struggling. So they've gone into a slight bit of a freeze response, okay? But you think about in the wild, and this is where I think domestic horses could be completely different. In the wild, let's say it's a let's say it's a gazelle in Africa or something or other. The lion chases it, grabs hold of the gazelle. The lion chases it and the gazelle runs. So it's in fight or flight. The lion catches it. Okay, there's no use being in fight mode when the lion's got his teeth sunk in you because it'll rip yourself to shreds. So you just go limp. Okay. Lion takes you back to wherever their cubs are, and one of two things happens. They either eat you, you're dead, or they might actually put you down for a minute because you're in that flop state and they might do something with their cubs and you've got a chance to jump up and run away. But in the wild, you do not stay stuck in freeze mode. You either run away and you go back through fight or flight, back to homeostasis, or you die.
Yep.
But there is no, the lion doesn't put a chain around your neck and tie you to a tree and keep you as a pet. And so I thought with these foals, I think just holding on to them for that umbilical cord treatment stuff is the start of a little bit of shutdown, because they go into, you know, they struggle, but then they can't get away and they kind of go into freeze mode. So what I'd do with them is I'd hold them after we'd done the business, whatever we had to do, and just grip them loosely, you know, under the tail and under the chest, and just wait for them to try to walk off. And when they tried to walk off, I wouldn't hold them until they really struggled. But when they tried to walk off, I'd hold them until they just started to pull against me a little bit, and then I'd let go. Those three have been the easiest horses to do anything with. I haven't had to, I never had to teach them to get in the trailer. They just got in the trailer. And they're all three different types. Like the oldest one, Chance, he's quite sensitive, could be a bit weird. I don't know if you're into swirls on horses, but he's got the weirdest swirls all over him. Like, you know, the second one has got kind of sunken in piggy eyes, and he's the sort of horse that if you tried to make him do stuff, he could get very resentful. And then the youngest one is like the most skittish one you've ever seen, sort of thing, you know. But we started working on having a consent-based approach with these foals. So once we grabbed a hold of them that first day and got what we got done, we didn't touch them after that. And we'd just go in there in the morning with my cup of tea, and I'd sit down and, you know, you just wait for him to come start investigating you. And, you know, the first one, it took a while. Second one, yeah, it took a while. I know a while might be weeks, you know, whereas the third one, he took months before he'd come up and say hi. But they're the quietest horses now. But it's just understanding that, and I'm not saying holding on to them while you draw blood is a, while they struggle and you draw blood is a bad thing, but it is a slight bit of freeze response. And I think every time that happens, if you get more and more of that freeze response, then you're starting to deal with an animal that is living in freeze response quite a bit of the time, and you think that's normal.
Yes.
Like, we think that's how horses are. And it's either one or the other. You know, they're either, you have, you have quite a bit of freeze response, or you have a quite bit of flight response, and depending on how you've handled the horses. But I think there's a place in the middle where it's neither of those. They can actually be in homeostasis around us and quite relaxed around us without, you know, like, so, you know, you're from the English world, you train hunter jumpers and stuff. And in the English world, I tend to see a lot of horses that are problematic are usually quite anxious. You know, they're bucking and they're rearing and they're bolting or whatever. Whereas in the Western world, or in, say, in the, I hate this term, but that natural horsemanship world, I think there's a lot of use, without knowing it, but a lot of use of that, if you're into polyvagal theory, that dorsal vagal tone, to where you know, you think about in a lot of natural horsemanship things, like, oh, if the horse won't stand still, move his feet here, move his feet there, move their feet, and after a while they won't want to move their feet. And that's just exhausting that flight response until it turns into a freeze response. Yeah. And it works very, very well. I mean, and I always relate it to how I grew up. I grew up, everybody's parents had the same parenting style. It wasn't like it was my mum and dad and everybody else was doing it differently. But, you know, the parenting style when I grew up was stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about. And we were, you know, we're all trained to be very quite obedient kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, conditioning a large group of people to be a certain way. And I think horses are kind of the same. Do you know who Ty Murray is?
Mm-mm.
So I had Ty Murray on the podcast. Ty Murray was the greatest rodeo cowboy ever lived. Okay, they call him King of the Cowboys. And now he's really into the horsemanship thing, and like, he's down the rabbit hole pretty deep. He sent me texted me a meme a while ago. And it was, you know, for me, reading this from Ty Murray was interesting. And you people at home who know who Ty Murray is, you'll find this interesting. But he texted me this meme. It said, "Parents, repeat after me. It is not my goal to raise children who obey my every request. It is my goal to raise children who trust me to see them clearly, hear them fully, and delight in them daily. Trust is more powerful than fear. Connection lasts longer than control."
Yes. Yes. Yep.
Yeah. And so for me, you know, like with these horses of mine, it's just been a fascinating experiment. I've never heard of anybody holding on to them until they struggle. But I have not really heard too many people talking about, you know, well, I suppose you do, the free, you know, those nervous system states. Well, probably the ones I hear talking about are the equine assisted therapists, you know, but not necessarily the horse trainers.
Well, it's one of my absolute passionate topics to teach around, is, you know, this whole idea about the confusion between, you know, having some sort of bond or connection and appeasing behavior, and how, you know, how these different training techniques manifest appeasing behavior, and that gets confused with, oh, the horse likes me, oh, he's doing, you know, he's connecting, and just the incredible importance in my mind of teaching people about pressure and the use of pressure and what pressure actually is. You know, we think about horses in the wild, right, in their natural state, is a horse will apply pressure to another horse for seconds, and then they'll release that pressure as soon as the appropriate space has been attained, you know. And we hold horses under pressure for such a long period of time until they go into that shutdown response. And then there's no way out, right? Just what you're saying. There's no way for them to get out. So what they do is they've learned how to be appeasing. So they're like, you know, because fighting isn't, you know, they can try fighting somewhat, but they're not probably, it's probably not going to work too well for them. And so the best option much of the time is that appeasal that comes with that shutdown, you know, that comes in that shutdown place. So I am passionate about this topic for sure.
Which brings us back to, did we ever get to the answer of, okay, equine assisted therapy, why is it working?
Oh my gosh. Well, so many reasons. I think, which direction to go with that? I think that horses being a human that can effectively be with horses takes a whole lot of stuff, right? It takes an attitude. It takes skills like you've been sharing today. It takes, I mean, both of those things you've spoken into today, right? Beautifully around both attitude and skill. And then it also takes practice, you know, a deep level of practice. And so for me, learning how to be around horses teaches us how to be better humans. So that's for me, first and foremost, is the act of learning how to be a good horse, like, I don't know how you call it, because it's not like you're necessarily teaching them horsemanship or horse skills, right? But there's something about being the kind of human that a horse wouldn't mind, you know, hanging out with for a little while.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. So I told you we've moved to this place in Paso Robles 3 months ago. So we bought it because we wanted to be more in the kind of transformational space, not just the horse training space. And so we've been having retreats down here, and they've been the first lot of the retreats were called Being with Horses and Yourself.
Yeah, love
and
that.
It was people don't bring their own horses. They might do a little bit of stuff with our horses, but it was more about, it was less about the training of the horse, but how to be the person around your horse, like you just said, that might be someone you want to hang out with. And it's so, you know, it's so different than teaching people to train horses, because it's not necessarily what you're physically doing on the outside that is the thing. It's how you are inside, how congruent you are, you know, how much expectation you have or don't have, you know, what your emotions are. Is it gratitude or fear coming out of, you know, all those sorts of things. Yeah,
absolutely. It's huge, you know, and so that's number one for me is that, and then beyond that, probably number two is the environment that horses exist in, right? So when you work with somebody with horses, you're working in nature and you're working with the elements and you're working with all the other beings that are out in that space. So it offers an opportunity to really lean into or explore this concept of we aren't alone, and interspecies communication, and, you know, biophilia, our natural connection to the, you know, to nature, and really getting in more in touch or in tune with we are a part, right? And so because there's such a loneliness epidemic, I mean, people feel so isolated so much of the time, and they're not always going to be able to be around horses, you know? And so helping people to make connection to the natural world through sort of the lens almost of the horse milieu, so to speak, you know? So the horses can be the draw. They can be sexy. They can kind of get you in the door. But then there's so many ways that you can work with people and show them that, you know, right now sitting in your living room on a Zoom call, you can look outside and see a tree and have that sense of connection and feel not so alone in the world. So I think that would be number two for me.
I am looking at the window right now, and I have this little thing I do whenever a tree is part of its moving. I just imagine it's waving to me, and I kind of give it a little, hey, dude, how's it going?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, we know from research that just looking out the window at nature can do amazing things for us health-wise. And so I think the interaction with horses is like a door, right? That helps people to make those connections that might be too weird for them or too sort of seemingly out there in other contexts.
Can we back up just a second?
Yeah.
You said that it's scientifically proven that just looking out at nature can, what did you say, can
can have profound health benefits. So
I would say though it's similar to horses though. If I'm looking out there going, that bloody tree's in the way and I'm going to cut it down, versus I'm looking out there like, hey, dude, how's it going? I'm sure, you know, like if you're looking out at the weeds and you're thinking, those bloody weeds, I'm going to pull them out, I'd probably doesn't have the same health benefit. So, you know, what I'm talking about here is your perception of the thing you were looking at. And that's, you know, it's the same thing with people and their horses. You know, a lot of people look at their horse problem as a problem. I usually encourage people to be curious about it, like wonder why they're doing that. Where does it come from? You know, it's you've got to get people out of that mindset of my horse is trying to be bad or a brat or or whatever. And I don't think you can do much change until you get out of that mindset, because you're actually creating that reality when you have that look at it. So that's a big part of what I'm trying to do these days with people is have them look at things differently.
Well, and I think part of that comes back to this idea of negativity bias, right? And how when we are in a dysregulated state, fight or flight or freeze, we're just going to see the world negatively. It's just part of the way it works. And so, you know, when I start seeing, you know, what, like, for instance, if somebody has, you know, nature trauma or just not even trauma, but like they're farmers and they have a totally different experience of grass than I do or whatever, there's this way in which we can also get, again, curious about what happens to their nervous systems in those moments. Like, so there's the person with their horse and the horse is having an issue or a problem. Well, I would bet that somewhere along that trajectory that they got scared by, you know, that something happened with the horse that scared them and that they are now, you know, they kind of moved into that fight or flight zone where they're needing to control, they're needing to, you know, and they're having those negative thoughts. So all this whole the cycle begins, right? And so to me, it's like we go back and we find that point, right? Of like, and we start looking at new ways to sort of experience our own bodies in relation to our horse partners, right? So like, when does it start happening for you? You know, like, is it when you're starting to drive to the barn? You know, do we start noticing a change in our nervous system, right? Do we start noticing a change in our thought patterning? Do we start noticing a change in our bodies? You know, is it when we get out of the car at the barn? Is it when we go into the tack room and get the halter? Is it when we walk out into the pasture to catch the horse? Is it, you know, where does it begin? And that's the pause moment, right?
You're talking about self-awareness right there, aren't you?
Just a little.
Yeah.
I just might be mentioning that. Yeah. Yes.
You know, that's the thing, isn't it? Like being, you got to get out of your head and into your body. One of the things, though, early on in our chat here, I asked you what you do when you said you're a transformational coach, then you do somatic stuff, and then you said the book and then the masterclass. But this is really somatic stuff you're talking here, isn't it? Like,
it's absolutely.
A bottom-up approach.
Yeah. And that idea of it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether we're it doesn't matter who we are. We all need this. Do you know what I mean? And so whether it will help you, whether you're working with a horse or a kid or a coworker or anything, you know, this sort of understanding of how we are, how our bodies respond to, you know, changes in our nervous system, to changes in, you know, what's happening around us, the environment, all those kinds of things.
Tell us about what sort of somatic work do you do? Because, you know, it wasn't that many years ago that I didn't even know what the word somatic meant. And now I've done quite a bit of somatic stuff. But what somatic work do you do?
Yeah. And I just want to say it's so funny how these buzzwords, right? Like, so this is the era of attachment theory, somatics, nervous system, you know, and it's just I always get a giggle of like, how these things have always been, except for that they then kind of have an emergence, which is super cool because people can really get hold of these concepts in real life, you know, instead of being sort of in books and stuff like that. So, but of course I just want to say like, they all go back to indigenous practices, right? All this stuff we're talking about. So just like putting up like a placeholder on, you know, on that. Anyway, so stuff that I do, all the grounding and centering that we already talked about, right? So just the five senses stuff, the body scans, the kind of experiencing the felt sensation of your environment. So, you know, your feet on the ground, what does that feel like? So lots of practices around movement, like if I'm working with somebody in a horse, again, before they ever go anywhere near the horse, I'm even working with them on how they are walking. And I'll do that with people on Zoom. I just did it with a client the other day of like literally how you are walking has so much information and it can change how you're thinking, you know, how we carry our bodies and how we, where we're holding tension. And so
do you know what pronating is?
Mm-mm.
When your ankles pronate is when you're.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Right. Yes. Okay.
So I was a terrible pronator for a long time, for probably till I was in my 30s, I think. And so you think pronate. So pronating is when, you know, when you're walking and your ankles kind of collapse in and you end up walking on the side of your shoe, not necessarily on the heel of it sort of thing. I was a terrible pronator until I started doing yoga. And looking back now, I realize the pronating was just being in the collapse state.
Okay. Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I had no internal energy and I was just like a melted candle.
Yes. That's a perfect example of the connection, right? Of if we work either which way, right? Whether we're working from the outside in or the inside out, that those two systems are so directly connected, right? So just like with a horse, you know, when I'm assessing a human, I can tell all sorts of things about them just by the way that they hold their bodies, the way they move across the floor, you know, and we start to see where things are stuck, right? And then we can do some work around that, right? So we can sort of go into those spaces with the permission of the body and the spirit and the mind, right? We can go into those spaces where we're holding those things and do some guided imagery to see what's in there. And the most amazing things show up, you know, when people are willing to ask their bodies, you know. So the question that I have clients ask is, you know, like, okay, high shoulder, you know, what do you got for me today? You know, what do I need to know?
Are you like doing internal family systems on body parts, aren't you?
Well, the IFS work is profoundly intermixed. It's amazing like how different parts of us actually show up in different body parts, right? Mm. So we find, I think of IFS a little bit differently, but like here's this, you know, 6-year-old that's trapped kind of in this chest region. And so the person can tell you like what it looks like in there, you know, what's going on in there, what's the experience of that part in your body, where is it stuck? What's happening to it? And then we can look at ways to actually work within that. So is there something we maybe bring into that space that would be healing or useful? You know, does that little person want like a wonderful fuzzy warm blanket, you know, or a cozy couch or sunlight or a tree or a favorite animal friend, you know, or whatever, like what makes that space feel less scary and dark or less tense and tight. So sometimes it can be that sort of stuff, like parts work. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's literally just memories held somewhere. Sometimes it's almost beyond words, right? It's just something, a sensation where something has gotten, stuck or kind of cobbled up that we can find ways to help move. So lots of like physical movement practices.
You know, it's funny. Therapists used to say to me, so how does that feel? I'm like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
my body doesn't talk to me. I don't know how that feels, you know?
Yes.
I can tell you, right. I can tell you what I think about it.
Oh yes. Oh yes. And that,
I can
and
tell
that
what
is
I think
probably
about it, but,
uh-huh. You can imagine how much of my time is spent helping people in exactly that moment of learning when our heads are taking over and our thinking processes are happening and how that blocks our ability to actually connect to and feel what goes on in our bodies. So that becomes the first step, is even just having that conversation and me starting to call them out when that's occurring, right? And then bringing them back into that awareness place. And can we do that? You know, is that even safe?
Right. You said earlier on that you are a transformational coach. What do you have, like a typical client, or is it like, are you like in the C-suite, or are you, you know?
I would say that, so it's a great question. So part of my journey has been to kind of move away from traditional psychotherapy, right? So that's how I practiced, you know, I practiced as a licensed mental health professional for many years. And then for various reasons, really sort of seeing a need and a desire to shift away from that. First and foremost, for my own actually personal reasons of recognizing that we travel a lot, we move a lot, and recognizing that like being there in the way that a psychotherapist needs to be for a client, it was just not actually within my capability. So that sort of started me on this journey of, well, what else could I do, right? Like, here's stuff I'm really good at. Here's things that I have to offer. How could I do these things within the legal framework that exists, within the ethical framework that exists? And that's how I landed on this particular sort of approach that I have. And so now things like my clients do matter greatly. So I work with people who can self-regulate, right? So like, sure, I teach them skills and increase their ability to do so. But they're the kinds of people that, you know, at the end of a session can feel pretty triggered or pretty uncomfortable, and then can, you know, really get themselves where they need to be and move on with whatever it is they're doing, and that they're seeking kind of advanced experiences or kind of an advancement of that knowledge. Yep. And that we can touch on or be with trauma and hold it in our space and really acknowledge what it's done to our bodies and our function, but that's not our, like, we're not working on that trauma, so to speak. Like, we're working on the way that trauma has now kind of manifested into these other behaviors and perceptions, and maybe that there's some skills we need to be learning. So the therapeutic work, if I'm working with somebody where that trauma is really primary, that's not going to be the right, I'm going to refer that person to a psychotherapist, right? A trauma, you know, highly skilled trauma trained person. So those are some, those aren't maybe great examples, but those are maybe some.
Yeah. Okay. You know, so before I do these podcasts, I always send my guests some questions to choose from. Yeah. And in your responses, you kind of said, oh, I kind of like keep it ad lib sort of thing. You know, I listened to some of the podcasts where you didn't ask questions. So I don't have the list of questions here, but there's some of them I actually want to ask you. So I'm just going to freestyle some questions.
Okay, go for it.
Do you have a favorite book that you recommend? Not your favorite book to read, but one that you tell people about more than any other book. Like, you should read this book.
I was thinking about that when I was reading the list, and I couldn't put my finger on one specific book. I feel like I gravitate, you know, it's like, depending upon what somebody's, what they're sort of experiencing or what's coming up for them, then I might, like, I think about The Body Keeps the Score, right? I mean, you've talked about a ton of them that are just like, just critical books. You know, then I think about things like Man's Search for Meaning, you know, or I think about, like some of the Carlos Castaneda books, but like, I wouldn't refer those to just anybody, you know, or I don't know. So I don't really have like one book. And over the years, it's been really interesting to notice how I'm also recognizing that for a lot of people, they need like little chunks of information. So I've been curious about that too, around finding that sort of recommending books hasn't worked as well as it used to.
Yep.
So I find myself almost more sometimes like searching for and collecting, you know, pod little pieces of podcast or a little, you know, YouTube video or a little blog somebody wrote. Like, that's what I'm noticing, is that it's maybe the packaging is even different than it used to be for what people are, the way they ingest information too. So I don't really have like an exact book that stands out to me. Lots of books.
It's funny you mentioned Man's Search for Meaning, because those questions, a lot of them came from Tim Ferriss's book, Tribe of Mentors. And so what Tim Ferriss did was he had 300 people on his podcast or something or other, and during the pandemic, he sent out a list of questions, and it's very similar to that list.
Yeah.
And then he said, reply to answer any question you want to answer, all of them, answer only one of them, whatever you want to do. And then he compiled all the results of that into this book. And Man's Search for Meaning, out of all the people that answered the what book do you recommend, Man's Search for Meaning was the top one, I think.
Wow. That's amazing.
And think about the sort of people that – do I have Tribe of Mentors here? Do, but the list of people in this book – amazing. Everywhere from Rick Rubin to Yuval Noah Harari. You ever read Sapiens?
Seen it in the bookstore. I literally almost bought it, not that long ago. I had my hands on it. It looked amazing.
You know, Gabor Mate, Tony Hawk, Jimmy Fallon, Esther Perel, Arianna Huffington, all these, Ashton Kutcher. Just a broad array of people, and just got all their answers. But yeah, Man's Search for Meaning was one of the I think was the top book. Do you have any? I forget how the question is posed. Do you have? Well, I think it is. What's an odd or an unusual habit or hobby you have? Do you have any unusual habits or hobbies you'd care to share?
I'm sure I do. Let me think. Unusual.
Now you're probably thinking, boy, I wish I had him ask the questions that I wanted.
It was funny. I read the list and I was like, gosh, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure about that one. So I just figured I would answer it however I came to answer it at the moment I answered it. But an odd or unusual hobby. I mean, I feel
or
like.
Or pastime or.
I don't know odd. I mean,
it's all right.
I feel
you don't
like,
have to have an odd one. I just thought it'd be interesting if you did. What about this one? If you could spread a message to the world, one that people would listen to, what would that message be?
I read that one and as well, and just really, I think that probably one of the really important things for me is what we've been talking about really so much of today, which is this idea about learning about animals and nature from a different seeing, getting curious about animals and nature from just a very different view than we've had for so long, you know? So really challenging the ways that we have been and perceiving animals and nature. And I feel like with everything that's happening, the idea of developing a greater sense of respect and connection is vital for our survival as a species, right? Because if we continue to see ourselves as separate from the choices that we make, will inevitably probably, affect us as well. So yeah, just really wishing for and wanting something to shift there or continue shifting.
Yeah, I think that, I think there is a big shift underway, and I think part of it is I think the internet. I mean, there's no reason to have a uneducated view on anything these days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you think about people's political views or religious views or whatever. It's what you're exposed to growing up. And if you, like me, and grew up in a small country town in Australia, you only get so many views.
You're not exposed
to a lot of different viewpoints of things. But now with the internet, there is no reason to have, you know, a small sequestered kind of a view about anything. But the other part, I think, is what's so fascinating, and you're in the mental health field, is the science is now backing up indigenous practices and ways of being, especially to do with mental health, to where, you know, they used to be able to classify that as, oh, that's you know, that's an indigenous thing, whatever. But now the scientists can actually, you know, with functional fMRI, you know, fMRIs and things like that, you know, now we can actually prove that those things are not only work, but they're very, very beneficial.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. It's such a gift, right, to begin to kind of unite all those pieces of information.
Yeah, you know, someone that I really like listening to and reading things that he posts or books of his is Gabor Mate. Have you read much? Have much to do with Gabor Mate?
Yes, pretty remarkable human, I think. I mean, I've never gotten to meet him, but just his writing and his, you know, his videos and the things that he speaks into. He's a very, very influential, very powerful human, I think, right now.
Yeah, he's book The Myth of Normal. Have you ever read The Myth of Normal? Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Yeah. To me, it was like, oh, you know what? When I first started really looking into trauma and stuff, like reading Waking the Tiger, did Peter Levine write In an Unspoken Voice? Was that him as well?
I can't remember. I don't think so. I'll look it up.
So Bessel van der Kolk wrote The Body Keeps the Score. So I think it was The Body Keeps the Score that was one that kind of tied a lot of different ideas together for me.
But
Gabor Mate's The Myth of Normal, it's kind of like the last 5 or 6 years of stuff I've been into.
An Unspoken Voice is Peter Levine.
Okay, so he wrote those two. But then when I read Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, I'm pretty sure that was the one that kind of, all this stuff that I've been looking at was pulled together. But Gabor Mate's The Myth of Normal, when I read that one, I was like, a lot of it wasn't, that's something I didn't know. It's like, yes, that links that together. It's a lot of stuff that I'd been looking into for a number of years. And so, if anybody hasn't read Gabor Mate's The Myth of Normal, highly recommend it.
Agreed. I second that.
And the other thing I was going to ask you about was your masterclass. What do you do with your masterclass?
Yeah. So that is it's supposed to be eight months, but it goes longer a lot of times, just given the content that we cover. So it is a very intensive experience of understanding equine-assisted mental health and equine-assisted learning. The primary focus, or not the primary, a huge focus, let's just put it that way, a huge focus is understanding horses, understanding equines, because one of the things I've come to learn in my part of this whole industry of, you know, horses and humans and well-being and all of that is that people just don't understand horses very, very much, or at, you know, at a very sort of, there's not a lot of education and training in that. So this masterclass covers a pretty deep, robust piece around getting to really deal with these topics we've been talking about, delve into these topics we've been talking about, and really looking at how we interact with horses and how we can do that differently. And then there's another big piece that's very much about our personal, like we've been talking about, around self-awareness and really understanding our own systems, our bodies, our nervous systems, how we show up in the world, you know, and the notion of self as therapeutic tool, right? So like every time that we sit with somebody, think about like Carl Rogers, you know, I mean, that was what he, one of the hugest gifts that he brought to this work is the idea that our presence, how we are, matters. And so I have a sort of a saying around like how we do one thing is how we do all things. So this class is a way of not only integrating practical, you know, skills, knowledge, information, but also really taking a hard look at how we show up and how we show up kind of in all these different places in our lives, and that how we show up really matters when we're working with any kind of client or horse. So that's a really big focus of the class. So I have people come that are going to want to be providers, right? That actually want to go out and do the work. I have people come that are horse people that will never have no interest in going and doing equine assisted mental health or equine assisted learning. But they just want to understand horses better and they want to understand themselves better. And they want to know about this, like as a sort of, just so they know, because it's a part of the larger horse industry, right? So,
you know what I realized a while ago is that horse trainers should become therapists. And I'm talking about horse trainers, especially, maybe not especially, but, you know, horse trainers who are training people, training horses and the people for competition.
Yes.
Looking back now, because I did that for many years, and looking back now, it's like, it's all about the mindset. And yeah,
It's huge. It's huge. And, you know, I mean, I know we've talked about this today, but it is completely night and day. When you change your mindset, when you're able to do the kinds of things that we're talking about, when you're able to show up aware, regulated, when you know how to regulate yourself, when you know kind of what's self and what's other, you know, when you have these skills, the horse part of it, it's so easy. You know, the horses aren't the ones that need the training most of the time, right? It's the humans that are the ones that need that. So if we can do that, you know, and so imagining like that, you know, in those competition settings, you have everything going on. I mean, all this hyper stress, you know, performance anxiety. I mean, the horses, you know, everybody's all completely dysregulated and it's a mess. And so it's a perfect opportunity for, you know, horse trainers to also know these sorts of skills to help. And then the horse will just go in there and do
what they're trying to do.
What they're trying to do without us getting their way.
Yeah. I've got a friend who trains, dressage horses and, jumping horses, and she does the hunter jumper thing as well, the hunters. Anyway, she told me she was recently at a show. She said, I know I'm getting somewhere now. She said, I was at a show and my client was ready to go. The horse before her was in the ring and she was at the back gate and she said, something's not right. She said, hold my horse. And the lady jumped off her horse, pulled off her boots and socks and went and walked on the rocks. She said, I need to ground myself.
Perfect.
Walked up and down for a minute, pulled the socks on, put her boots back on, jumped back on the horse and went straight back in. I was like, that's cool. Like knowing in that situation that this is the best thing I could do right now.
Yes.
Jump off a horse, pull her boots and socks off and go and walk on the rocks or the grass, one or the other, forget what it was. But it was a somatic grounding type.
Absolutely.
Type thing. And she went in there and did great.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I mean, it is, I absolutely know that if horse trainers and horse people got these skills, like really understood these skills and got them on board, that the rest of it is generally easy, you know?
Right.
I mean, and that's when we go back to understanding horses in the wild and from an ethological standpoint, it's like, these sorts of behaviors that we see acting out, these are things that we create,
right.
You know? And so if we're the ones that learn how to change ourselves and the way that we're showing up, the horses generally just don't do those things, which is what we were talking about with your babies, you know, they just, it's just different, you know? So I completely agree that, you know, anyone that is out there listening that's a horse person, the more information about all these kinds of things, you know, that you're sharing, Warwick, and that are out there now to grab onto, you know, the better, because it's only going to make the horses happier and healthier, and then us happier and healthier and safer, because we won't have those conflictual relationships.
I think it's a big circle as far as, like, I have a lot of people say, you know what, since I started doing your stuff with the horses, I'm getting along so much better with my husband and my kids and my boss and my coworker. You know, it's
absolutely.
It's sometimes the things they do in other lives help them with their horses, but sometimes they help the horses help them with other parts of their life. And I think it just becomes a big energetic circle.
Yeah. Well, it's because we're the constant, right? So how we show up with the horse is going to be the same as how we show up with our husband. And so if we learn, wherever we learn it, it sort of doesn't matter. Like, you know, we can learn it either with another human or we can learn it with a horse, but it's how it's us. It's how we are and how we change and how we can show up. That's going to make the difference in all those circumstances.
I couldn't agree more. So Leif, how do people find more about you?
Probably easiest thing is just my website, which is just leifhallberg.com. So
And what about social media? You got anything going there?
I just have my Facebook page, which is sort of a amalgamation of, you know, it's kind of a opportunity for me to share with people that I work with and people that are interested in what I do, share a little bit about me and who I am so that they kind of get to know me that way. So that's fine. I, you know, I'm not always that great at accepting friend requests, but I try.
Oh, you don't have a professional page?
I don't have a, you know.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And that's okay for now. I mean, so pretty much just my website is the way people find me.
Okay. Well, that's how they can find you. Thank you so much for joining me. I've had a blast chatting with you. I love what you're doing in the world.
Thank you. It's been really fun. I'm so glad we got to do this and I got to meet you finally. I've heard so many great things from my students that are your students. So that's been a really cool interchange of, you know, ideas and thoughts without you even knowing it probably.
Well, that's very cool. Right. So thanks again. You guys at home, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.